Nicole London, co-producer of The Birth of the Cool, directed by Stanley Nelson. Tell me how you became involved in this film in particular. I know you've worked with Stanley before.
Yes, so I had worked with Stanley on Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution. I think I started that project with him in 2014. Mm-hmm. We worked on a bunch of small films for the National Museum of African American History and Culture. And then I went off to do some other stuff. I worked on a Sammy Davis Jr. documentary. But then when this finally came through, this film had been 15 years in the making, various fits and starts. But finally, when Eagle Rock and American Masters had come through with the funding, Stanley called me, as someone that's worked on music documentaries before, as the person to produce it.
Do you have any history of your own as a Miles Davis fan or a jazz fan? What's your Miles background?
I mean, I'd always been a Miles Davis fan. I was more of a John Coltrane fan.
Okay.
And I remember running out and buying Doobop when it came out. I was a freshman in college. I'm dating myself now. But I didn't like it. So I was kind of disheartened. I just, kept with my Kind of Blue and Blue Train. Those are my two big albums. That and Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers. Those are my favorites.
Right on, right on. Now, Miles Davis, of course, one of the great stars of jazz, a different way through many, many decades. A full life, not only musically, but personally. A two-hour documentary seems like there's no way you can get it all
in. It's not enough.
Well, tell me about that challenge.
It was very challenging. We had approached we had a treatment of the film, which you never looked at. After a while, we knew there were certain points of Miles' life that we wanted to hit on, certain albums that we wanted to hit on. But to cram in a life like Miles Davis really requires minimum 4 hours. We didn't have that. But I think what we did was kind of encapsulate the major points of why he was so relevant, why he's still relevant today. Just wanted to live and breathe in that music for 2 hours, which we do. And as people will see when they come out to the film.
Now, one of the I think interesting things that people will notice right away is you've got Miles Davis narrating the film, or so it sounds. The actor Carl Lumbly narrates in Miles' voice and uses a lot from the 89 autobiography and other interviews. Tell me about that decision, how that process went.
That was actually not the original plan. We actually had gone to Quincy Troop, and he'd gotten access to the interview tapes that he'd used to create that autobiography. We also had hundreds of other hours of Miles in, various interviews, audio, video. But those were to be the bulk of what would take up this narrative. And they were just not usable. We spent about 6 months in the editing room trying to use these tapes. But Quincy went in very informally with Miles because they had become friends. And they were sitting and talking and watching the game. They would order lunch. They would cook. And so the tapes were just a nightmare to work with. And on top of that, Miles didn't necessarily answer in full sentences. So it was really hard to kind of construct a narrative from that. And so we turned, after we gave it the college try, we turned to the book and used the audiobook as like a template to kind of collage out a framework for the film.
Now, the actor isn't the only one doing a Miles Davis impersonation. Everybody who talks about Miles loves to get into that raspy voice. Yeah. Do you do an impersonation of Miles?
Have you tried it? I will not inflict that on you. And it was a thing that we encouraged people to do that, actually, because they would do it anyway. And they were like, oh, sorry, I slipped into Miles for a second. Like, no, please do that, because we knew we kind of wanted to have that be as an element in the film. And I think it works out well. I mean, just because people can't help it.
Right. Now, there's plenty of film and photos of Miles throughout his career. He was really well covered, but you've got some really interesting, fresh material. Maybe most interesting is the film from his friend Corky McCoy. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
So I contacted his daughter, Blair McCoy, and gotten in touch with Corky himself. Really worked on, getting them to trust us with this material, because other work had been done on Miles before, and they were just very protective of their relationship with Miles, and we wanted to do that justice. And so, finally they felt comfortable, and they gave us everything that they had, and what they had was amazing, not just photographs, but also Miles boxing, Miles driving in one of his Ferraris in the late 60s. Miles as you've never seen him before, and so we really wanted to, we used just about every bit of it, to be honest.
And you had a lot of great interviews, not only with critics, but with some musicians who played with him. I think I'm most interested to hear the interview material with his wife, Frances Taylor. If you tell me about that material.
Unfortunately, I have to preface this by saying Frances passed away last November, before Thanksgiving, and she never got to see the film. But what people will find when they sit down and watch it is that Frances is luminous, and she's a character. And she's probably the person that epistle, as a term, was coined for, because she's just so vibrant, vivacious, and you believe everything that she believes about herself as, the best dancer, the best legs. And she was just wonderful to work with, and she's so dearly missed. But I know that people... the first thing they come away with is loving Frances Taylor, mm-hmm. and, really understanding that part of the story of Miles Davis is the tragedy of Frances Taylor Davis.
Yeah. I think something a lot of people are thinking of when they say, there's a Miles Davis documentary, is they're flashing back to the Don Cheadle movie Miles Ahead and thinking, well, this is what I want to see. Or maybe they're thinking, well, this is going to be the dry talking head documentary. There are probably people on both sides of that fence, you think? Mm-hmm.
Well, I would have to encourage people just to come out and see for yourself. Mm-hmm. It's nothing like the Don Cheadle film. That's right. A narrative film and largely fiction. Mm-hmm. And so, there are different goals that are, that are the end result of that. We are trying to give a nuts and bolts, life and career of Miles Davis, encapsulating everything. And I think people really come away with not just a sense of the man, but of the music itself.
I think one of the best reviews you've had was from Miles's nephew, Vince Wilburn Jr., who's part of the film, who he said it brought him to tears, and Miles would have loved this film. You talk about working with Vince Wilburn Jr.
So Vince was great to work with. He was constantly calling and texting with do you need help? Do you need, numbers? Who can I give you? And so he was great as a collaborator. But aside from sort of initially having contact with Vince and, getting phone numbers, the family was really comfortable with just, standing back and letting us do the work of putting this film together. They didn't even see a cut till maybe a week before Sundance. When it's too late to say anything.
That's kind of smart.
But they were all great. Everyone we worked with on this film was fantastic.
It seems like this movie, I'm excited mostly because it seems like the definitive factual story of this most remarkable life that ended in 1991. He was only 65 years old, but he lived such a full life. It's also, it seems to me, the story of American music, and it's the story of jazz, and it's the story of an African-American artist through the 20s. This is certainly a racial story, too.
Yeah, it sure is. It really does take you through a kind of American history, especially through the lens of someone who in a lot of ways lived outside of what, the racial narrative could be. Miles was rich growing up. He was kind of what would one consider a country squire. But, being also a black American in East St. Louis, Illinois, subject to segregation. So, his wealth and privilege could only take him so far there. This is also somebody that was classically trained, at least for 2 years at Juilliard, mm-hmm. And prior to that. And so he was not somebody that just had come up, self-taught, as so many jazz musicians are believed to be. Mm-hmm. This was somebody that had real training and real understanding of what music is and the concepts behind it, underlying it. And so, Miles was just different in every possible way. He was what you would consider a Renaissance man today.
Now, he had a bit of a reputation. As much as everyone loved his music, he was an arrogant, abusive, at times antisocial and bitter. He would play with his back to the audience. I think it can be difficult to reconcile the art that you love with an artist that may not be as lovable. Right. It seems like the film addresses that,
we
too.
We do address that, and I think we do that without, belaboring the point as well. Mm-hmm. Miles is all of that. He was... he was arrogant. He was oftentimes, quote unquote, a bastard to work with. Not to work with, but to be with, I guess, suppose. Most of the people that worked with him loved working with him because he did give them freedom and space to kind of develop their own voices in the material. But on top of that, you can't ignore, all aspects of a life. And we kind of trying to spread all that out and really present that to audiences to make up their own minds of what they felt about it.
Now, I've had a chance to talk to a few of Miles' fellow musicians and people who he's worked with over the years. And the parts I remember talking to John Scofield about working with Miles, and I said, yeah, he was a superstar. And Scofield said, you have no idea. Everybody wanted to hang out with Miles, kings and politicians and movie stars. And he had a real superstar status that was uncommon for a jazz musician, especially.
Right. I mean, Miles, you know, despite all the stories and, you know, the aspects of his personality, he was a, kind of a fun person to hang out with. He was very witty. Everyone tells, you know, stories about how funny he was, even as a man of few words. He was extremely funny. He was personable as a host. He would cook for you once you got into, like, his inner circle. He would sit you down and cook for you and just talk to you as, like, a one-on-one. He really had really great relationships with a lot of people that came into his life. And most, for the most, you know, aside from the drugs, you know, I think who knows how that would have played out.
I got a chance to talk to Marcus Miller about working with Miles, and the one thing he was so excited to mention was how flashy and stylish Miles was, and was a real innovator, not just in music but in fashion too. Is that involved in the movie at all?
Yes, we do touch on that. We touch on Miles as being sort of a style icon from the 40s on. He was actually, we couldn't really quite work it into the film, but he and Roy Haynes in particular sort of had like a rivalry, you know, sartorial rivalry going on between them. And they were both cited in Esquire magazine in the 60s as being best dressed men, along with like Fred Astaire. Fred Astaire, Fred Rogers is Mr. Rogers. And, you know, Cary Grant and, you know, other notables of the day. So he was always sharply dressed. And then, you know, he kind of did a turn in the late 60s around Bitches Brew, which we focus on in the film. And then again in the 80s, which we kind of don't touch on. But, you know, he was one of the first people to really embrace, like, the Japanese designers and the more avant-garde fashion that a lot of artists, you know, kind of shied away from, especially jazz artists anyway.
Right. Now, something interesting I find is that there's another new Miles Davis record coming out. I wonder if you touch on the Rubber Band album at all.
We do not. Not okay. In this film. We kind of really focus up until his death. You know, we hint at the kind of things that would have been coming had he stayed alive. You know, that he was kind of the godfather of a lot of musical movements that came after. But we really don't go past his death in 1991, so we don't really touch on doo-wop. We're just trying to keep it focused. Gotcha. In that way. But yes, I'm excited. I actually haven't heard the album yet, but I did remember seeing those tapes in the storage space in L.A. as I'm rummaging for archival material. So now I'm finally glad to see what was on those.
I think one of the quotes people are talking about in the documentary is Miles is talking about how music is a curse and how it consumed him. But I wonder if, in another way, music was his saving grace, kind of his salvation.
I think so. I mean, we call it the full quote, I believe, is it's a blessing and a curse. So, I mean, music was everything to Miles. It came first. And that's the curse of it, because, you know, because of that, all else must suffer in terms of relationships, especially in terms of with his children, you know, with, you know, lovers and wives. All those are secondary to his musical career. So that's, you know, it's a blessing and the curse, as he said.
Now, I'm sure there is a lot of material that didn't make it into the documentary. Is there going to be any release of that cutting room floor material, or is it finished?
It's pretty much finished, yeah. I would say. There is going to be a soundtrack that's coming out. Ooh. That we're working on with Sony that would probably be timed to the broadcast, which is in February of next year.
For PBS, so, am I right?
For PBS, that's correct, on American Masters. So, you know, stay tuned to the end, and when you get your tote bag, get a DVD and a CD at the same time.
Okay, and finally, back to your career. Now, this is an assumption I make just because I seem to see more documentaries coming out. Does it seem like that filmmaking process is getting more economically feasible, and we're going to hear more jazz stories, do you think? Because there are hundreds of stories out there worth telling.
I think so. There was a John Coltrane film just about a year ago, and then a Blue Note film that came out around that same time. So I do think people are like looking to jazz as kind of inspiration. I Called Him Morgan. It was a fantastic film that came out. Actually, those three films all came out around the same time, about two years ago or so. So I do think we're in a really great moment for jazz music and jazz music documentaries. I'm not sure why that is. Maybe it's because we're kind of hitting anniversary times, you know, 50 years since this album or 60 years since Kind of Blue, for instance, which just passed. So I don't know why, but I'm glad it's happening.
Me too. All right, that's all I've got for you, Nicole.